We've got a great chat and a conversation today, which I am really, really, really excited about.
We are going to be talking about structuring a real estate investment with very little money, with a lot of money, whether you own the land, whether you don't own the land. But on our last group coaching call, I got a ton of questions about how to set this up. So I think there was a lot of people that are thinking about putting a deal together that don't maybe own the land, that want to own the land, or maybe they own the land and they need capital. There's a bunch of different scenarios. We are going to go into a lot of them. I'm going to share with you some shared experiences of my own and how I would recommend you structuring this. And this would apply to all real estate. So whether you're doing like a hotel, a micro resort, a landscape resort, an apartment building, anything that you want to do, these strategies and these structures are going to work for you. I think the best place to start is just with a very simple concept. And that is you have found an amazing piece of land and you want to build this beautiful resort in the Texas Hill Country, and it's going to be experiential. There's all these cool cabins that you're going to build. You're going to have a food and beverage component. It's an hour away from Austin. It's going to be the next greatest hospitality experience other than Yamagiri, which is like the highest revenue per key hotel out there. Yours is going to be the best. So I think what a common scenario that you might find yourself in is you find this piece of land and you don't have capital to acquire the land, or you find this piece of land and you do have capital to acquire the land and then you acquire it. The third scenario would be you seller finance it. The fourth scenario would be you get together a group of your friends and you all buy the land. But let's just start with a very simple scenario first, okay? And this is an outright purchase of the land. So let's just say you used all of your hard-earned savings to buy this amazing real estate site. And all it was some beautiful topography and a field and a water, and there was maybe a barn on it, but there was nothing really else there. And what you started doing was you hired an architect and you kind of did some space planning. You figured out how many cabins you could build. You started generating your business plan. You started talking to contractors and figuring out how much everything is going to cost. By the way, I should mention in this scenario, let's just say you have no experience. So you don't have a hotel company. You've never done this before, but you're like a really smart, creative entrepreneur, okay? So you get all this stuff done. You're working. You get an architect to draw up a beautiful set of plans. It looks amazing. Maybe you even have some people out to this land and they're all enjoying it, having a good time. And you think there's a real business here. So you start putting together a deck. And if you've talked to me before, you'll know that I'd recommend your deck not be 100 pages. Your deck should be probably 20 or 30 pages, maybe even less, because it's just a piece of land, right? So you could probably do everything that you want to say in 20 pages. And now you're ready to start talking to investors, but you're kind of stuck because, yeah, you own this land, but all you really have is kind of a site plan. You have some pretty pictures, you have renderings, you have a business plan, but you don't really have anything else beyond that. But you also don't have any money because you used all your money to buy the land and to hire someone to draw a few pretty pictures, and you spent all this time coming up with the business plan. So I want to talk about some of the ways that you can overcome your lack of experience and also the fact that you don't have any money to really move forward. So in this scenario, I think you have really two options, okay? You can try and raise capital from your friends and family who are really going to add no value to what you're doing. Or you could potentially try and partner with someone that is maybe a little bit more experienced than you in the space and sees value, sees opportunity in what you've started. So let's talk about the first thing. Let's just say you have some really rich friends and a great network, which you should always be building and establishing your network and preparing to raise capital. And you want to go raise money from them to kind of take the next step in the land. And you might ask yourself, well, what's the next step? Well, the next step is going to be to finalize all of your construction plans, because without firm construction plans and firm design plans, you really are never going to be able to get accurate construction pricing. And without accurate construction pricing, your development budget is not for real. And certainly your pro forma and your whole investment model is not for real. So you want to get these plans and you want to get your entitlements and your approvals in place so you can actually build everything that you're dreaming and that you're imagining. So that's what you're going to use this investor capital for. And if you're doing this, I think there's kind of maybe one or two ways, probably two or three ways that you can actually do this, okay? In the friends and family way. You could say, hey, friends, you guys are going to be taking a lot of risk because I know only what I know. This is a barren piece of land that we're going to be creating. So you can structure it a couple of different ways. You can say, hey, I'll let you guys in at kind of the friends and family early discount where you're going to come in alongside me at my basis, my direct cost for the land and my direct soft costs. And then once we get everything approved, once we have our plans all designed, I'm going to raise a second round, and those investors are going to be investing at slightly different terms. Maybe they're going to be paying a promote. They're going to be paying carried interest. Maybe the land that goes into the deal is going to be marked up at a higher value. But for the first early investors, they're going to come in at the existing land price, and they're going to kind of share the risk of the soft costs. And maybe they won't pay any promote because they're taking some of that risk. The other thing you could do is just say, I have a lot of confidence in my ability to raise capital, and I'd like to bring investors in at this stage, but I do think they should pay a promote. And I think I'm going to give them a slight discount on that promote compared to the other investors that come in later when there's less risk. So now, since there's a lot of risk, there's a lot of uncertainty, maybe instead of, you know, the investors getting 80% and me as a sponsor getting 20%, we are going to, lower that where the investor keeps 90% of the capital and I only get 10 for the initial round. Okay, that would be one scenario for bringing in friends and family in this early round. Now, if you remember, the other thing I said you could do is you can go out and get kind of a co-GP partner, someone that's done this before, someone that has experience, someone that maybe has built something before, someone that has experience getting things done. Maybe it's a hotel partner. Maybe you're not really a hotel person or a multifamily person. You're bringing in a managing partner to help you get this thing along. Maybe you're the creative person. You're the dirt dog that found this site that's amazing, that's, you know, one in a million. And the co-GP investor is going to come in, but also add significant value. And maybe they're going to even add more value than you. So that is kind of the two different scenarios that I see at the earliest stage as to how you would take the next step once you own the piece of land. Now, we can back up if you don't even have the money to buy the piece of land, but that to me are really the two main options. And then from there, there's like 100 different scenarios that you can come up with. And I want to talk about just a few of them. So let's say you buy the piece of land yourself and you bring in some investors to help you with the soft costs. Now you're at a point where you've gotten all of your approvals, you have your plans in place, you have your construction costs laid out, you've been talking to bankers, you've really got your pro forma dialed in, and you're ready to take the next step and raise capital and go close on your construction loan and get this thing going. You have a couple different options when you're raising this kind of second round of capital, when you're ready to go. Do you bring those second round investors in at a different waterfall structure like we talked about? You could do that. You could also increase the value of the land by what you've done, by what you've created, and put in that increased land value into the deal. So for example, let's just say you buy the land for $1 million and then you kind of raise $300,000 from friends and family and you get your soft costs done and you get all your approvals done. So now your basis in the land is $1.3 million. But you talk to some appraisers, you talk to some smart people in the area, and they say, well, now that you have your approvals, now that you have your entitlements, now that you have, you know, all your utilities set up, we think the land is worth $2 million. So you bought it, your basis is $1.3 million, now it's worth $2 million, you're getting ready to raise the second round of capital to go build the thing. Do you put the land into the deal at $2 million? Do you put the land into the deal at your base and your investor's basis at 1.3, or do you do something in between? I think you do something in between because that's going to be a great way for you to raise investor capital on that second round. And you say, hey, the land is really worth $2 million, but we're giving everyone who's coming in on the second round a discount on the land, and we're going to value it at $1.6 million. So everyone who invested at $1.3 million kind of has a little more imputed value. It's like they're putting more equity into the deal. And the new investors coming in second feel like they're getting a fair price. And then you can, you know, structure whatever waterfall or promote structure that you want. Another scenario is one in which you've created a lot of value in the land. And let's just say you'd like to take some chips off the table, not because you think you're selling at the high or you're going to sell it and leave your investors holding the bag, but let's just say you only wanted to invest $1 million in this deal. You spent $1 million to buy the land and you don't want to have $1.2 million or $1.3 million or whatever it is in the deal. You just want to have $1 million, or let's just say you just want to have $500,000 in the deal because in your model, you as the sponsor, you only wanted to put up 5 or 10% and you got the land approved, you did all this work, and now you want to just take a little bit back but still have significant dollars in the deal. You could also sell off some of your position. And then you go through the same scenario. Do you sell it off at your cost? Do you sell it off your profit? I think personally, you sell it off with some profit, but you still give a discount. And it's perfectly acceptable and reasonable to take some chips off the table at a higher valuation if you still have meaningful skin in the game and allow some new investors to come in when you move to the next phase, and that's on the construction loan. So we've talked about a land JV. We've talked about kind of different ways to think about a JV with investors depending on their level of sophistication. I want to now back up a little bit. And let's just say you identify this land, but you don't have the ability to capitalize it. Then what? Like, you don't have the ability to buy it. Or you don't want to take the risk to buy the land until certain milestones are met. And maybe one of those milestones is getting the approvals to build what you want to build. And that could be because the seller wants a premium for the land. You kind of don't see eye to eye, but maybe you would pay the premium if you had all these approvals together. So a couple things you could do there. You can get seller financing from the seller. If you don't have any money, get him to finance you. Maybe they finance 100%. Maybe they finance 80%. Maybe they finance something less. The other thing you could do is basically take an option on the land and you tie up the land. You tie up the land so you don't have to put up any capital. Maybe you put up a deposit, but you don't have to put all this capital up, and you go get your approvals and you go spend money on the soft costs. So the seller knows that you're serious because you're spending real capital. You're putting up real money on the soft costs and you're going to get approvals. But if you're going to get approvals on someone else's land where you have an option, you better make damn certain that that option is really ironclad, because you don't want to be stuck in a situation where you get the site entitled and improved to build and you come up with all the plans and then somehow the seller can back out and then try and take your deal. So you really want to make sure your option is ironclad. Now, why would the seller give you an option? Well, if the seller gives you an option, he has to take basically his property off the market and he's foregoing a current payment until something in the future that is not that certain. So he might be inclined to do that if he's owned the land for a long time and been unable to sell it. He might be inclined to do it if he's owned the land for a long time, has very little basis, and you're going to pay him a nice profit on what he might have paid for the land, and he's willing to wait for that. But in order for you to get that, you're going to have to show the seller that you're committed, you're serious, and you're the right person to do it, because they're going to be betting on you that you have to get all this stuff approved for you to close on the land. But I think that's an awesome way to do a development deal today, because not only are you not putting up your capital all at once in the beginning, but you are basically giving yourself time to invest in the soft costs, to invest in the approval process, and to go out and raise capital for the deal, so you don't have to worry about putting your capital up with basically no return during this early phase. So I think that's a great structure. Another thing you could do, which I don't really recommend, and unless it's a very, very, very unique situation, is you can do a ground lease. So you can set up a situation where the seller retains title to the land, and you're basically doing a 99-year lease from this person. And maybe your payments don't start for a couple of years, so that gives you the time to get ramped up. The reason why I don't recommend ground leases in all situations is the reality is a ground lease is essentially additional leverage. It's just you levering up the property in another way. But it's an encumbrance on the land. And it's always going to be more challenging to raise investor capital and to go get traditional bank financing if there's a ground lease, because the ground lease has priority of payment to the construction lender or the lender that will ultimately be loaning on the building or whatever project you're building. Now, if you're not building anything on the site, and maybe you're doing like Airstream trailers or tents or something, and you're not creating major infrastructure, then maybe a ground lease works for you. The other thing that I want to talk about is a co-GP situation. So again, you haven't bought the land, you don't have enough money to buy the land, but you're a super creative person and you've really come up with this amazing idea. You think your land that you've gotten under control is very unique, but you really don't have the wherewithal to go through with it. That is a great opportunity for you to bring in a co-GP who does, where that person is going to add either capital raising value, development value, operational expertise, legitimacy, maybe because they have years experience, they can bring in debt. But you as the sponsor really need to know your role and be intellectually honest with where you are. Because I get pitched a lot of deals where someone's looking for a co-GP partner, but really, and I don't say this being rude, but like the person has zero value to me. All the person did was bring me a great deal, introduce me to an opportunity, but like they're not going to add any value operating whatever it is. They're not going to add value building it. Like they're just really inexperienced, maybe uncreative, whatever. So it's important if you are that person that you know that you are that person and structure a deal accordingly, because it is always better to have 20% of a watermelon than 100% of a grape. Okay. Because if you are the guy that says, no, I need a co-GP and we're going to split the promotes and I get these big development fees and this, that, and the other thing, but you're not bringing capital, you're not bringing expertise, you're not bringing value other than a deal that's just kind of like a deal, but not like all of the components of a deal, then you may need to give some up, ride along, but let someone else take the reins. Now, you might be a co-GP where you add significant value. Maybe you've spent the past 2 years entitling this thing. Maybe you're a former contractor and you know how to build it better and more intelligently than anyone else. Maybe you're going to be the project manager. Maybe you're this amazing idea guy, you're an amazing hotel operator and executor and visionary, and the whole thing is going to be your vision, but you just need capital. Then that's a different story. So in a co-GP situation, which I love, it's really important that each person in the co-GP role knows their role and adds value. So a couple personal situations that we've been in that have been tremendous for us in a co-GP capacity. In one situation, a group came to us and they had owned a parking lot for years. And they got full approvals. They got a brand tied up with Hilton to build a hotel. They had the construction budget lined up. They're very experienced builders, but they couldn't get a hospitality loan because you need a hotel operator attached with the ownership group and you need a lot of experience. And they could raise the capital, but they wanted a hotel person that was also going to have skin in the game and that was going to invest. And we did that deal and it was tremendously successful. And what we brought to the table was construction expertise, lending expertise in the hotel world, operational expertise. And what they brought to the table was the deal, all of the entitlements, all of the construction work that they put in up to that time, and all of the soft cost work, which was very good, architectural, engineering, all that kind of stuff, design. And they were also bringing a very significant project management role to the table as well. In this deal, it was a mixed use component. So they had a lot of experience with retail. They were going to be the retail managing partner. The other thing they were bringing to the table was they were going to be the accounting partner for the deal. And they were going to be the tax matters partner and they were going to handle all that. So it was really very, very strong alignment. A more recent deal, we are building a Moxie Hotel in St. Pete, which is going to open in August. That partner spent 2 or 3 years going through COVID, getting entitlements on the land, getting it approved, designing it, coming up with a whole master plan, buying the site. But again, they couldn't get it over the finish line because they needed a hospitality partner to legitimize the deal that was also going to bring significant capital to the deal because they also needed capital and they needed someone with hotel expertise. But they had construction expertise, not necessarily the hospitality expertise. So for us, it was a tremendous opportunity because they've been working on this deal for 3 years. They needed us to come in. We kind of came in at their basis, which was also very fair because we were going to contribute a lot of value going forward. And for us, it was great because we're having the opportunity to do a development project, but we didn't have to invest 2 or 3 years of our time to get it to this point. They had already done that. So that was a lot of value to us. You know, contrast that to effectively like a broker coming in and saying, hey, I want to be your partner. Well, what are you going to do? Well, I brought you the deal. Well, it's like, okay, But then we got to structure it for that relationship, because you're not going to add value that's going to be really meaningful to us along the road. So let's just structure it in a way that makes sense for the relationship that we have, the skills that I'm going to put in, that you're going to put in, so that it's all fair. And I found in my experience that really makes for the best partnerships when everyone knows what they're doing. And when you don't set unrealistic expectations of your partner from the start. The other thing that I'll say, and then I want to jump into some questions, is right now in this world, I think there's a lot of risk with development. It's very difficult to get construction financing. There's still a disconnect between value, what sellers are willing to trade at, and what buyers are willing to pay. So if someone came to us with an opportunity that is baked, we would be interested as long as they were going to put in the work going forward, or they had already put in the work and it was coming to us almost like a package, because the opportunities that we're seeing today, we could earn basically almost like development level returns without having to take development like risk. So for development deals that we're looking at today, we want to find a way that some of that development risk for us is mitigated, or we can get a significant upside based on our contribution, some value that we bring to the table that might be unique. So that's where I will leave it. And I'd love to go to questions, because I'm sure there's a lot of questions of things that I didn't cover, but that people want to talk about. So if you have one, just raise your hand.
Do you have an experience building outside of the US or into a territory? Have you guys ventured out yet?
That just wouldn't be that interesting to us, because I think there's a lot of risk in that. The only way that we would be interested in that is with a local partner who has significant advantages in that market that would be able to mitigate that risk, and where we could add some sort of unique value, or where we would be able to imagine an investment upside that is far greater than we could get here in the US.
Question about one thing you didn't mention, but the underwriting, like what key metrics would these investors or partners want to see? I feel like online, I do underwriting on different deals, land deals, and like other projects, investments. But, you know, I'm just curious from your perspective, what you really want to see in that 20-page deck.
So let's talk about it like in the two tranches. So let's just say it's the type of deal where you acquire the land, or you are acquiring the land, and you're kind of bringing in like a small group of people that are really taking a lot of risk, and they're really just betting on you and maybe the location and what your dream is. What you're going to want to show there is some very conservative base level underwriting that I think is going to be heavily driven by research that you've done based on similar projects and opportunities. So what does it cost? What can I sell it for? And what is my annual cash yield? So in order to generate that, you're going to need a hotel pro forma, a hotel P&L, and you're going to need a construction budget. You're going to need some lender assumptions, and you're going to need some cash flows through construction and then through stabilization. But it's going to be very loose, and you need to really tell people like, hey, this is generally where we are targeting. So we're looking at some deals, right? We're not really looking at them, but we've seen some deals recently where some people have brought us some stuff, and it's pretty early in their process, and their basis is very, very high. And in my opinion, it's probably only going to increase just given the world of construction costs that we live in. So if I'm already thinking the basis is high before, you know, we have plans drawn up and a lot of time has been spent, it's probably not going to be that interesting to us. What would be interesting is if you had some unique or competitive advantage that is like lowering the basis from the start to make it so obvious where I could just do, I like doing simple math. So it's like, okay, you mean to tell me like your basis in this thing is like $200,000 a room. I know the market is $700,000 a room. Let's just say you're completely off. Okay. You're like crazy and you're 50% off. So it's really going to be $300,000 a room, but the market's still like 700,000. Like then I have coverage there. But if you're coming to me with a deal today and you're like, hey, you know, we're working on this thing and based on all of our analysis, it's like going to be $650,000 a door or a key or whatever. And the market's at kind of like 700,000. This is not a lot of room for error there. There's not a lot of margin. And then in the second round, when you're really raising capital, when you're getting a construction lender, you're about to start, you better have as detailed an underwriting model with very little wiggle room as possible. When I say wiggle room, you want to have a hard bid from a GMP or from a contractor with a GMP. You want to have a decent contingency. And what a decent contingency is in my mind is 10% on a development deal today. And you want to have operating performance that is based in reality, based on actual comps from other properties. And I would like to see the real numbers from the other properties. So you can either get that through Smith Travel Research if they participate in that by talking to other people in the market. But like, you know, you can't just only rely on like looking online because that's not necessarily the full picture of what, you know, the rates are and what the occupancy is. Hopefully, and then you want to have a full hotel performa that was vetted by someone who knows how to operate a hotel. So if you're not the hotel operator, if you're not the hotel expert, then that should be generated by the person that's going to operate the thing for you.
Over the past few years, from like 2019 till now, especially in development, have you seen like a certain pattern where like, if it costs, you know, $150,000 today per unit to build a hotel, you need a certain RevPAR. Like, have you seen like a certain trend, like at a certain cost per key, you need a certain RevPAR essentially?
I wish it were that easy. And maybe like back in the day, it kind of was like, it used to be like, if you had $150 RevPAR, you know, you could build it for $150,000 a key and be okay. But it's not all, or sorry, it was $150 rate. And that kind of assumed 60% occupancy. But in certain markets, the occupancies are nowadays 70, 80%. So there isn't that sort of metric. I think you need to underwrite each deal on its own. There's no like quick back of napkin where, hey, this is going to work. But you will start to see patterns and things will start to be obvious. Like, for example, like I'll tell you guys, you know, we were looking at buying a note on a hotel where we were going to foreclose. And the note, the original note, I think was like $70 million, something like that. And we bid like $18 million. Okay. It's like a huge wipeout, right? Why did we bid $18 million? We bid $18 million because there's only $1 million of income. And it was operated by a very, very proficient manager. So let's just say you take some assumptions and let's just say, oh my God, this manager who's really a great world-class manager, but I'm going to tweak it. I'm going to do things differently. Let's just say I'm going to get up to $2 million a key. And then I put a cap rate on that. People were bidding on this thing up to like 35, 40 million. Like if you put a 6 or 7 cap on that, maybe I'm getting to 33 million. But again, like I'm basically paying the seller for all my upside. So right now is a market where I think you need to be really analyzing deals and making investments based on cash flow and income and not just per key. Because in this market that we were looking at, historically buyers have paid on a per key basis, but like that only lasts so long. Like when interest rates are zero, I guess you can do that. But in a world where interest rates are not zero, I don't think the per key metric is the one where you can feel comfortable buying on if your NOI is not there. Now, if your NOI is there, then maybe you can, But you, another thing we're seeing, which is like, especially in the kind of this experiential outdoorsy space, where it's like a small hotel and it's like, I don't know, call it 10 to 20 rooms. And the thing sold for like $800,000 a room or $1 million a room. And you could say, well, you know, the income was justified or the price was justified by the income. It's like, yeah, sure. But you're paying $1 million a door. Like when you go to sell it, what's someone going to pay you? Are they going to pay you $1.2 million for like a cabin in the woods? I don't know. You know, a lot of crazy things have happened. I remember when, 15 years ago, the Mandarin Oriental in New York City sold for like $500,000 a key. And I was like, wow, that's expensive. That's crazy. Now, like, you know, $1.2 million, $2 million, I think, is the record in New York City. So certainly things can happen, but we're talking New York versus a cabin in the woods. So I think you really have to put things into perspective, and income is definitely going to win the day. But it's got to be checked and moderated by price per key.
When do you think pricing correction will happen in the hospitality space?
It's coming. It's coming because you're going to have people that are forced to make a decision. If your lenders are going to keep allowing you to extend, then you don't make a decision. But now you're getting time where people are having to make a decision because the debt is coming due, the debt is maturing. Or maybe they took private preferred equity or something like that. Like we made some preferred equity investments and we had the right to force a sale in 4 years and we're coming up on that time. And it's like, dude, sorry, like your equity might get wiped out, but we're going to make a lot of money on the pref and we're not just going to wait around forever. So that will open up transaction volume. But I would say in the next 12 months, we'll start to see that.
What is a good IRR for the LPs in today's market? And also, since you were talking about development for both a value-add project and also for a development, for instance, like you were talking about, you can say for you as well as a GP.
Yeah, so I'm just going to say for the deal, because I think it's easier to think about it like that. So when we're underwriting a deal, if it's a... like we're doing preferred equity deals right now, or it's like high teens IRR. So it's going to be like a 17, 18, 19% IRR. 3 or 4 years ago, you would be underwriting a development deal to probably somewhere around that level. So in my view, I think a development deal needs to be above that. It needs to be like certainly higher than 20%. And by the way, that's really hard to achieve. So that's why I think there's a high bar for development right now.
So you mean for the overall project, right? So it would give like...
Yeah, for the overall project. From an investor standpoint, it's, you know, it depends on your investor base. But what I would say is if the project IRR is 500 to 600 basis points higher than the investor IRR, then you maybe have too much of a promote. And you might get pushback. So that's, I think, kind of a good range to think about and to operate in. And I think it's also important to think about multiple as well. You know, like what is going to be the multiple of equity? Because for a development deal, in a lot of ways, that's maybe more important. I mean, IRR is driven by like private equity returns who are justifying their asset management skills to pension funds. But I think a lot of investors that I speak to that are high net worth or family offices are very focused on cash on cash return and their multiple.
And when you speak cash on cash return, you are always talking about yearly, right? Then
Yes. Which with hotels, you know, as you ramp up is going to change over time, but hotel cash flows are lumpy. So you really got to look at the whole year because depending on where you are, you might have terrible cash on cash returns because that's your slow season.
Yeah, exactly. Also here, I mean, I don't even know if people know about that private equity type of structure. So I am still figuring out here in Portugal how things are. I'm obviously always comparing to the information that I have from you and everything. And yeah, I'm not sure if people here are like used to that type of structure. So we will see. I mean, I'm talking about the banks and everything because the financing here is also different. We have like leasing and we don't have the type of financing that you guys have that you only pay interest and everything. So things are very different here.
Yeah. You know, there's different structures throughout the world. And I think private equity has fallen into one box. But, you know, the simplest way to look at it is like what's called sweat equity. So if I put up no money or very little money, but I do all the work, how much are you, the investor, going to pay me for making sure that you get paid and that you earn a good return? So like just a simple way to think about that is like, okay, once we sell whatever we build or whatever project we work on together, you get all your money back, plus maybe some base level returns, somewhere maybe between 5% and 7% or 8%. And everything above that, we split 20% to me and 80% to you. That, to me, regardless of what country you're in, is a very universal concept.
So a lot of the deals I'm looking at are they're hotels that have existing keys, let's say 10 or 20, and there's the zoning and the acreage to expand and develop, let's say another 30 to 50 keys. So when I'm underwriting these deals, I'd love to stay super conservative and underwrite based on the existing infrastructure and almost assume that I'm never even going to do any development. But I feel like I'm going up against, I'm sometimes going to be going up against other buyers who are going to value the development upside into their underwriting. And if that's the case, they can justify a higher basis and I may lose out on that deal. So I'm curious like how you balance staying super conservative and maybe valuing some of the development upside.
This is an awesome question because I was having the debate with Charles, who leads our investments today. And I would say a couple things. I'll save the funny answer for last. But one, some people might have a different cost of capital than you have. Okay. So they might be willing to pay more because they are planning on earning less. They also might have way more experience or way more certainty than you have about unlocking value. That's number two. Number three is some people are just dumb and they're going to overpay for things and you're never going to be able to, you know, mitigate that. But ultimately, it depends how realistic and viable it is. So if a seller is selling you something and it's like, well, like, I think you can do like some extra stuff here. We really would typically underwrite what's there. And maybe depending on the negotiation, we'll pay a little bit more relative to what we think we can do. But we will vet that out like extensively, conversations with lawyers, conversations with local municipality, like really, you know, maybe we'll even do a loose site plan, really figure it out. There could be another scenario though, where the person already got approvals to build what you want to build. Then there's real value there, but they have to leave enough upside for you to make money because you're still taking significant risks. You got to build it. You've got to, you know, rent it up or lease it up or sell the rooms. The other thing that you need to be very cognizant of is whether it's viable, whether what they're showing is actually viable. Because, you know, they could say, hey, you could build like 50, you know, cabins over here or another 50 units. But if that's going to cost you an insane amount of money because the soil is not stable and the construction costs are going to be out of control, you know, then it's really not worth what they think it's worth. So ultimately, it comes down to due diligence and doing a significant amount of due diligence to be able to make a reasonable guess as to what additional risks you're taking versus what additional price you're paying for the upside. But our base case scenario is always we're going to just pay you for what it is. If we can do something more, that'll be our upside. If it was so easy, like they would have, you know, why didn't they do it?
Right. Yeah. No, it seems nuanced. I guess one quick follow-up question to that is like on the equity and debt side of a deal like that, my thought is it would make sense to raise equity to just cover the purchase and like the phase one cosmetic renovations that don't require permits or approvals. And then once I stabilize the existing asset and get the approvals, at that point, raise the additional equity slash debt. Because it seems like it would be less dilutive at that point because the value would be higher. Is that a good, do you think that's a good way to approach it? Like versus raising equity today to cover a renovation that I may not even end up doing.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a good way to do it because you're going to have a cost of that capital, which is going to smoke your promote, smoke your upside if you don't end up using it. Even if you do end up using it, it might be sitting around for a year or two and it's just, you know, really inefficient use of the money. A couple of things you need to think about is, you know, what you say to folks in the beginning, because if some folks are just investing in a cash flowing asset and they don't want to be a part of a development project, they should know how that might look. The other thing you're going to need to think about is that the same partnership? Am I just selling this component to a new partnership? Because if you raise outside capital, you know, you're kind of diluting everyone, you're upsizing the process. So you really have to invite all of your partners to participate, but you should disclose what you're going to do. And I would always disclose the worst case scenario in your docs. And then if it becomes better, it becomes, you know, better. Another way that we've mitigated it is, you know, if we're going to build on additional thing and we go and get the approvals, well, we'll put like a certain land value to that thing day one. And then once we get all the approvals, we'll have the new land value day two. So your existing investors will own that appreciation and kind of get like a nice little lift. And the new people will pay the higher value. And the lender will now finance across the whole project, but with a higher value over here. So that's one way where your existing investors will benefit without having to put in extra capital and without having to like get diluted.
I really want to thank you for your podcast. You add so much value, especially bringing in those guests like Mehul, Mitch, Homi, Ben Wolf. It's quite amazing, you know, how it helps us to see where the trend is moving. So my question was...
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. My question is, I'm in Destin, Florida. We're doing this unique experience stay hotel, which is a 64 key. Each room have their own private pool and a spa. So does experience stay hotel work pretty much in any market, or it all depends as per, you know, your feedback? So there is the Hampton Inn across the street, which does about 50,000 a key and annual revenue. So what's your take on that?
You can theoretically create an experience or a great hotel anywhere, but if no one's willing to pay you a premium for that, you might not get a good return on your investment. So you want to make sure that you're in a market that people will pay for. And I think a lot of that has to do with the location, frankly. So, you know, where are you in proximity to the beach? Like, what does your view look like? What does the building look like? There's a hotel that some guy built like in Orlando. And it's really weird because it's like in a random location. It's like in a Hampton Inn location off the side of the road. The outside kind of looks like a Hampton Inn, but the inside looks like a Four Seasons. And it's like, it's very strange. And I can't imagine for those reasons that they're going to be able to really make this thing successful. So I think the location actually has a lot to do with it. And that means the location, like the market, but it also means the location, like where in the market. So Destin is a really strong market, obviously, coastal market. But if you're like behind a Walmart, you know, in a field, you know, that might be tough. But if you're like on the beach, across the street from the beach, then I think you can create that experience. You know, we've like even built a hotel. Like I have the best hotel in Fort Lauderdale, the Delmar. And it's an amazing hotel downtown Fort Lauderdale. But if I could do it again, I would put the hotel on the beach because the beach is driving a premium to us. We can't catch the beach. I would love to be on the beach. So I think that is always going to drive a premium view, always going to drive a premium. But yeah, look at Homie. I mean, you like that podcast. He has the highest rev par in the country and he built that place in the middle of nowhere. But the location, the physical beauty of the location is amazing.
Yeah, especially on, he talked about that Hyatt Place story, how he managed to do so well on that part.
Yeah.
And that really, you know, made me curious to lead to see who was that person that he was talking about that helped his Hyatt. And I was able to find that team on the Instagram. But thank you for all that information, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's an example of also supply and demand, because like that's a cool market. And the Hyatt, like you have two options. You have the Hyatt Place and the Amangiri. It's like completely bookend. But it's also kind of funny because Amangiri has like major events and major weddings. And obviously you're not going to put like the band and the wedding photographer in a $5,000 a night room. So they end up sticking all these people on the Hyatt Place. So it like serves as a great alternate to the Amangiri, and they can still charge a premium, like a major premium, because it's the only hotel around.
Real quick, what's a good cash on cash return that you mentioned in today's market, Jake?
Oh my God. It depends like which one of my investors you ask. Okay. So right now investors can get 100% liquidity investing in like treasuries at around 5%. Okay. So you have to be higher than 5%, I think, to call it good, because you're completely illiquid. So I would be targeting somewhere between 8 to 10. But we also, like, we have a deal. We were telling an investor the other day, he's like, you know, the cash on cash return is a little bit lower than I expected. And it's like, well, yeah, but this is an 18-month hold. We bought this asset so low. The IRR is primarily driven through the sale, but we also are holding on cash because we saw an opportunity to reinvest in the property to potentially drive more ROI. So it also depends on the timeline, the time horizon of the investment. So if you're buying it super cheap and you're just like going to fix up a couple of things, then like almost like flip it, then cash on cash return, I think, is a little bit less the game and the strategy. But if it's like you're holding it for a 5-year investment, investors are going to want cash because they would look at alternative things that they can invest in with complete liquidity.
Really quick. So as far as the debt goes for a lot of these deals, I'm always going for seller carry first. I try to go the SBA route, but it seems like they're kind of allergic to like the LPGP structure. So for these value add deals, it seems like for some of the deals, bridge is like the only option. And it's hard to get some of these deals to pencil with bridge debt. So what are your thoughts about like trying to raise enough equity to just cover the entire like cost, the entire project cost? Because I'm looking at some like smaller deals where that might actually be feasible, and then stabilizing as fast as possible and then like refinancing out after like a year or two.
Okay, this has nothing to do with hotels, but we recently launched a new real estate vertical that we're going to try and grow, which is in industrial in a very specific area in Florida. And we bought our first deal all cash, okay, because we didn't like the debt options because the place was vacant. And once we get a tenant and there's cash flow, it would be completely different debt options. We also didn't like the debt options because, you know, you heard today there's probably going to be run rate cut, but like probably depending on your hold period, rates may go down. So we bought it all cash and we'll do a refinance maybe in a year, year and a half, pump out a lot of cash, and that'll be nice. I think that's perfectly fine. It's obviously going to impact your IRR, might not impact your multiple, but if it is impacting your IRR, you should explain that to investors and make sure they're aware of it and why. It's also obviously less risky because you don't have debt and they're saving on interest payments. The other thing you could do is take on less leverage and take on preferred equity. I mean, we're investing a lot of preferred equity right now. And the reason why preferred equity is good is because it doesn't, well, at least the way that we do it, is it doesn't require a current payment because we're investing in the value of the asset. So unlike debt, we don't have to receive current pay. Now, if there is current pay, we're going to require that like we get that money and it pays down our pref. But our return is also capped. So if everything goes as planned, the, you know, your investors will actually make more money because our return is capped, or we'll end up like stepping out and getting diluted out. That might provide some additional upside for your investors. So that's another option. But I mean, I think it's totally reasonable to combine seller financing with equity. And frankly, like it kind of sounds like a competitive edge and a good story. I think investors are looking for a story today. So when you hear seller financing, when you hear like kind of this creative financing stuff, it's just a little bit more interesting to investors than like, hey, yeah, we went out to like a local bank and got like the debt terms that everyone else can get.
When you're looking at deals, like, is there a situation where you would, like, in what situations are you looking for co-GP economics versus LP economics?
Where we're coming into like a someone else's deal type of thing? Yeah. Well, we're not LP investors. So we don't raise LP capital to go invest in other people's deals, except for preferred equity. So we would only look at being an LP if we were preferred equity. From a GP standpoint, we are, I'll tell you about a deal we're looking at right now, actually. So it's a guy we think is interesting, has a pretty good background, a good business plan. He's doing kind of whatever you want to call it, like experiential resort, a landscape resort, whatever. He's building, you know, well, we'll joke about it. He's building 50 cabins in the woods, okay? And he owns the land, but basically doesn't have the money to move beyond his initial planning and his initial phase of drawings. So kind of this scenario that I laid out. So what we're thinking of proposing to him is, hey, we'll put up the next $300,000 or $400,000, but we got to be like in some sort of priority in the lands. Cause we want to, like, if you know this project way better than us, but if all hell breaks loose, at least we can get our money back through the land. We're going to allow you to take this thing to the next phase where we can raise capital, go get debt, go fully budget it. But like, you go do all the work because this is your project and you're saying it's great. But like, let's be honest, like you don't have an infrastructure. I have 10 people in accounting. I've got a whole HR team. Like, I'm going to do all that crap for you. I'm going to help you raise capital. I'm going to get the debt. But like, you got to help. Like, you got to be there. And for that, we want to be like in the GP and, you know, get a piece of the promote. Maybe that's 50-50. Maybe it's 60 to us. Like, it depends on what we're all going to be doing and where we are. But to me, that's really interesting because I'm basically, it's almost like the tech world. You're like making a seed investment to help this person get started. And then we'll like help you do it together. Like, we'll be like your board of advisors. We'll have certain control. But like, you're still the entrepreneur, man. Like, I'm not going to be, you know, meeting with the architect every Monday in, you know, wherever this place is. Like, that's your job. Go do that. And I'll make sure you don't like screw up and like hire too quickly or, you know, make another mistake that we've made. So that's a cool way that I think is getting involved in a co-GP role with someone that is kind of just getting started. And obviously we've gotten involved in co-GPs with like other kind of equals where maybe we're the hotel person and they're just a real estate person, but we're, you know, equals. They bring a lot of value. They have a lot of infrastructure, but we both have our expertise. So those are like the two scenarios. Thanks, guys. Hope you enjoyed, and see you on the next one. Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.